Go behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi, and welcome to Car Stuff. I'm Scott.
I'm Ben. As always, we are joined by our super producer, Noel the Silver Arrow Brown. And, I don't know, that's not my best work.
Yeah, it's a multi-syllable name. We'll come up with something.
We'll come up with something better. Most importantly, ladies and gentlemen, you are here. And we have something that many of you will enjoy. We hope.
Yeah, we hope. Well, at least one person will. And it was a listener suggestion from Steve Pocock on Facebook, and he wrote a while back, and I think it was prompted by a visit to a museum that we'll mention later, the Buffalo Transportation Pierce Arrow Museum, which also, by the way, and I don't know if we'll mention this or not, but includes a Frank Lloyd Wright fuel filling station built inside. It was never built outdoors as it should have been.
Mm-hmm.
They took the plans and built it indoors, and it's just a really interesting museum, but we'll find out that that's not the official Pierce Arrow Museum as well, which I find really interesting. So hopefully we'll get to that part of this whole thing, because I was looking at my notes, Ben, from today, and I went a little overboard. You know, sometimes I say I've got too many notes and can't get to everything. This is going to be another one of those cases. I didn't think it was going to be this big.
You got roughly half the table, maybe, if you spread it all out equally.
It's like a ream of paper that I have over here, because I started going year by year through this company, and I got to, when was it? I think around 19, I finally got to about 1920, and I just kind of gave up. I'm going to have to go with, my margin notes at that point, but I had more detailed notes up to that point. So, again, a listener mail suggestion or a Facebook suggestion, rather. And, maybe we shouldn't start there just yet, Ben. You know where I'd like to start today?
Where would you like to start?
I'd like to start with your hat.
Oh, yeah. This is weird.
You're wearing a mystery hat.
I'm wearing a mystery hat. Yeah. So I have sort of a strange situation in my personal life, which is I just end up finding things and losing things. And much the way that you gave up going year by year in 1920, I gave up a long time ago trying to keep specific track of the things that enter and leave my life, which I know sounds wildly disorganized. And folks, yes, you're right. It's chaotic. So I get up this morning and I'm going through my closet looking for stuff to wear. I realize that not only are the majority of my clothes things that I don't usually wear, but a lot of them I don't recognize.
Never seen them before.
They're like things I wouldn't buy. They're things I wouldn't wear. They're someone else's clothes. Some of them don't seem like they would fit me. And one of the things I found was a Steelers hat, a Pittsburgh Steelers hat. And I wore it to work today. And we were off the air, Scott. You know, it was one of the first things I said to you. You said hello, talk a little bit about podcast, and I asked you if this was your hat, and maybe I had borrowed it from you or something.
Like it was laying on my desk and you just took it home?
Which I hope I would never be that kind of person, but I've never been to Pittsburgh. I've never even been to Pennsylvania. Where is this hat from?
It's a complete mystery. So, you know, you say that it's a chaotic way to live your life, you know, not really knowing where all of your stuff is at any point, or just gathering other things. But is it chaotic, or is it more like, maybe I'll not use the right word here, but is it more zen in that, you know, you don't own things. They just simply pass through you, you know? It's like you're using it for now, you'll trade it on later and then get something new later, you know, at a future date.
Thank you. That's a very kind way to look at it.
I know that's probably not the right. There's a different philosophy that I feel I'm missing here, but
I do keep it together for, I do keep it together for the basics. Like if I'm in charge of an animal, then I will take care of it. Yeah. You know, I don't let plants die. I don't just hop into random cars.
I feel like people are like this with tools sometimes. Mm. You don't really know where that tool came from. And if it's not somebody who's very, very, cautious about lending or as you sign the checkout sheet to bring it back, you may end up with a few of your dad's power tools or, a hammer here or there. Oh, that's another thing.
Oh, man.
Yep. Ben owns four identical hammers.
In a one-bedroom apartment.
So
one of them's a mallet, remember?
I didn't think about that until just now, but this is a trend with you.
I got a hammer for every room.
You live in an apartment, you got four hammers.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Well,
So
whatever works for you, man.
I guess it seems like I'll either – sometimes it seems like I'll either have too many of a tool or none.
Mm-hmm.
One time I had an oil filter wrench that was just an absolute POS, right, and a piece of stuff. And so I went back to my parents' house and to my dad's garage. He's got all these tools. It's like the Alibaba Cave of Wonders level of tools.
Not anymore. He's missing all his hammers now.
I don't know, man. Maybe. I'll check in because he listens to this show sometimes, so he might be really steamed right now. But I went back to say, hey, this is oil filter wrench. I don't need it. Do you want it? Otherwise, I'm going to just give it away or something. And then I said, and also in full transparency, it's seen better days. And he was like, the last thing I need is an oil filter wrench. And then he had like this little, like, not quite a pile, but too many for a home mechanic to
have. I can defend him in this instance because I probably have four or five of those myself. And the reason is that when you're out buying supplies for an oil change,
right,
that's one of those stupid items that you think, like, do I have the right one?
Like, I forgot.
You know, if it's not one of the adjustable ones with a strap on it, you might think, like, do I have the right one for this? And mm-hmm. I'll buy another one just in case because it's $3.
Yeah.
And I'm here, and that will be a second trip to the hardware store, the parts store, you know, in half an hour when I got my hands all covered with oil in a different vehicle. You know, it just becomes very complicated. So you think, well, I'll just spend the $3 right now. But then you go home and you realize you got four others already.
Better safe than sorry.
Yeah, I guess so. It happens.
So this has absolutely nothing to do with today's show, or barely anything to do with the subject of today's show. This instead is a PSA, a public service announcement. If you or a friend somewhere in the listening audience, whether in Bangladesh or Birmingham, Alabama, everywhere in between, if you are missing a Pittsburgh Steelers hat, a ball cap, I believe that I may be of some assistance. I don't know how it got here. I don't know where it's going. But if it's yours and you want it back, I'll gladly send it to you.
Well done. Well done. Very nice.
I'm trying, man.
Very nice.
So, Steve, what's going on with Steve?
Well, Steve wanted to hear about the Pierce Arrow Motor Car Company. And
yeah.
It is an interesting history. It's not very long, though. That's the thing. It's only been around, well, you know what? There's about 30 good years in here. And we'll describe those 30 years. But the companies that founded or that resulted in the Pierce Arrow Motor Car Company were linked. There's a longer history to them.
Yes.
I don't know how to say that better, in a better way. I'll tell you all the names of the companies that were predecessors to the Pierce Arrow Motor Car Company. So it started out as Heinz, Pierce, and Munshauer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, way back in 1865.
Then it became the George N. Pierce Company.
Mm-hmm.
And then it became the Pierce Motor Company.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, in 1908, it became the Pierce Arrow Motor Car Company. And that wasn't exactly it, because Studebaker gets in there later on in the 1930s. Mm-hmm. But all this begins in about 1865.
Yeah, in 1865, the predecessor of what will become known as the Pierce Arrow Motor Car Company is established, and it is, as Scott said, called Heinz, Pierce, and Munshauer. There's a fascinating thing here for anyone who's checked out our earlier origin story episodes or historical episodes. You often see this trend wherein what would become a car company starts out manufacturing something else. And this is one of those instances, because they were not known for transit really at all.
No.
For the first like 36 years, they only made household items.
Yeah, it reminds me a bit. Well, there, you know what? There's so many examples of this.
Yeah.
It reminds me a bit of Peugeot, of course, with the pepper mills.
Mm-hmm.
It reminds me also a bit of like the Kelvinator company that made or International, who made refrigerators.
Yeah.
You know, all these different
Honda
companies
with bicycles.
Yeah. Yeah. And remember, a lot of that comes from, we found out finally got a grip on what that meant and why they made household items and appliances and small appliances. And that's because of the refrigeration company. It's usually a refrigeration company that's then bought by an auto manufacturer, and they continue to use that name on that product. And it's a fascinating tie-in between small home appliances and automobiles.
Right. And it makes sense. It makes sense from a infrastructure standpoint, because the production capability that's already present for manufacturing appliances gives you a leg up.
Yeah. Yeah. So the Heinz Pearson Munchauer company built things like ice boxes and birdcage, gilded birdcages.
High class birdcages.
Yeah.
You know,
and I think I saw their name on the side of a wagon, maybe. You know, they build all kinds of stuff. I mean, that's just a few things, and it's tough to kind of nail down a list of exactly what they built. There's not a lot of information out there about this company.
There is there's an old Heinz Pearson Munchauer calendar, or excuse me, a catalog that you can find in from January 1876. But it's, you know, it's not exactly a bestseller nowadays.
Well, you know what? I'm glad you said that date, because if you go back 4 years prior to that, that's when the Pierce part of this whole company bought out the other two. So it was actually the George Norman Pierce Company at that point in 1876. So in 1872, that's when he decided to buy out Heinz and Munchauer. Mm-hmm. And he changed the name to the George M. Pierce Company.
Right.
And around 1896, which is a significant time later, they added bicycles to the lineup. And this is kind of a big move for them. I mean, because they hadn't really gotten into transportation yet at this point. And kind of the foray into that is bicycles. And there's a strange tie-in with a lot of bicycle manufacturers and auto manufacturers as well.
Mm-hmm.
Peugeot had a tie-in as well, just like we mentioned with the pepper mill stuff just a moment ago.
Yeah. And then another company that's going to play a decisive cameo in our story also was associated with bicycles.
Yeah, that's right. And I'll just mention the name now, but it's the Overman Wheel Company. And the Overman Wheel Company was the first manufacturer in the United States of safety bicycles. And those are the bicycles that have, finally, similar size wheels on the front and the back. Remember, before that, they had the old penny farthing designs, the one with the giant wheel in the front and tiny wheel in the back.
Which I find just dramatically obnoxious. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
They're coming back.
Yeah.
And it's these hipsters, right?
Mm-hmm.
In the U.S., they're located largely in New York, San Francisco, maybe Portland, Pacific Northwest. And I get it, man. I get that nostalgia exists. I understand that. However, the penny farthing design is functionally inferior, not even to modern bikes, just like bikes, like the safety.
Well,
you know what?
Maybe, terribly dangerous.
Maybe I should lay back and just let people be happy.
Probably should. Just
what
let
if
them,
I did that?
Let them pretend to be what they want to be.
What if I stopped being a cranky old man about about people? If you want to ride a penny farthing bike, do it. It's the Honda Odyssey of bikes, though.
You're better off on a safety bicycle, which by the way, I mean, come on, this is around 1900 when these things were designed. So if you haven't caught on to the safety bicycle yet, you know, there's something.
Well, you just don't want to.
Yeah, I guess so. So, you know what, let me skip around just a tiny bit in the timeline here, and we'll come back, I promise. But I just feel like we should get the bicycle and motorcycle stuff out of the way, because they built bicycles, and I just mentioned it now, but motorcycles. They also built motorcycles starting in 1901. Mm-hmm. So 1896, they added bicycles. And the bicycles were built by the Pierce Cycle Company until 1914. So that's a pretty good long run, 18 years.
Mm-hmm.
And around 1901, they started building motorcycles, a lot like the ones that the ones that we saw in the board track racing episode.
Right.
That was them. They built one and four cylinder models, and the four cylinder was apparently pretty wild, pretty fast.
Yeah.
And also they claimed vibrationless, I think, is what they said for that motor. But
yeah,
come on.
You can see some of those old advertisements. But they were quite successful with the bikes and the motorcycles.
Yeah.
They were building these at a location off Hanover and Prime Street on Buffalo's waterfront. It was a huge building, 75,000 square feet, and they even had a bicycle display at the Pan American Exposition.
Yep, and so that ended for the Pierce Cycle Company in 1914, but they sold the tooling for that bicycle manufacturing to a company called the Emblem Manufacturing Company out of Angola, New York, and they built Pierce bicycles for another 20 years after that. So long legacy for the Pierce bicycles.
Yeah, absolutely, and a pretty good legacy too, because they left the game without, you know, a threat of bankruptcy or some huge manufacturing problem. They were just successful enough with it that they later chose to sell it or spin it off and go to something else.
Not bad. Now let's jump back to 1900, because some things happened around 1900 that are interesting as well.
Oh, there was almost this amazing, game-changing innovation at Pierce Aero Company.
Yeah, almost.
They
attempted to build a steam-powered car. Yeah. But the attempt failed. It was licensed by a company called Overman, which we just mentioned.
Right,
about
the bicycle guys.
Yeah, the Overman Wheel Company. Mm. And here's how that came about. And this is prior to when it was organized as an actual automobile company. So it's still the Overman Wheel Company, the bicycle manufacturer.
Mm-hmm.
They sold all that off in 1900, or maybe it was right at that transition. I don't know. I can't quite figure out the exact timing on this.
Yeah, it's a little fuzzy.
But they reorganized in 1901 and formed the Overman Automobile Company, which then... well, at the time, they sold something called the Victor Steam Carriage, and they had really low sales. And then finally, Overman gave it in and then merged with a company called Locomobile in 1904. So it didn't last very long. But this foray into steam-powered cars for the Pierce Company, or the George N. Pierce Company, mm-hmm. didn't work out so well. It was a failed attempt, but they came back. And in 1901, the company built their first single-cylinder, two-speed, no-reverse vehicle that was powered by a DeDion engine.
Mm-hmm.
It was a single-cylinder, like I said. The very first successful attempt at
right.
building a car, I guess.
The Motorette.
Yeah, the Motorette. I forgot to mention the name of it, right. It had a 2 3/4 horsepower engine, and they only made about 170 of these cars.
Yeah.
So you can call it a success. I mean, it sold, which is mm-hmm. good. I would guess that at that time, selling 170 vehicles is pretty good.
And there's a reason for this drive. And to get to it, I'd like to explore a little bit more of George Norman Pierce's background.
Oh, yeah, okay, sure.
Cool? All right. So George Norman Pierce is born in Friendsville, Pennsylvania. Maybe that's where this hat came from.
Sounds nice.
January 9th, 1846.
Doesn't
yes.
that sound pleasant? Friendsville?
It does. It sounds like a town where a comic book hero grows up. So he, at the time, was a highly educated man. He had private instruction. He attended a place called Waverly Academy and went to Bryan and Stratton's Business College in Buffalo. So when he got to Buffalo, 1863 or so, for 10 years after that, he worked for various manufacturing companies. And when he was the sole proprietor of the newly formed George M. Pierce Company, he was also obsessed with visions of the future. He knew that, you know, household goods were going to evolve, but still kind of evolve at the same pace, like a refrigerator is always going to be a refrigerator, right? No matter how immensely improved the technology may be, it will still have the same purpose.
Sure.
However, transit and transport, while they have the same purpose, can use radically different technologies to get there. And that's when he began thinking big about the car. So he was the singular driving force there. And he had his son, Percy P. Pierce, also on board with this, prophetic is one word. I think that's a little bit dramatic, but his son was active in this in a more social aspect.
Yeah, Percy Pierce, his name's going to come up later on. He worked for the company. He drove for the company as well.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll talk about Percy. Did you have more to say about also his history? Because I don't have a whole lot about George's history, really.
George's history is a little bit difficult to hunt down.
He's a visionary, right? So he reminds me, the way you're describing him, he sounds a little bit like Tucker. You know, Preston Tucker.
Yeah,
in many ways
they're similar.
But you know what? Now that I say Tucker, I can't single out him without saying he also sounds a little bit like Henry Ford. Sounds a little bit mm-hmm. like, some of the other people that, John DeLorean. I mean, all these people mm-hmm. that, you know, were just, they had visions. They had, they're visionaries. They want something, to evolve a little bit faster and they're going to do it.
Right. Yeah. And, I believe that Percy was his oldest child. He ended up having five, all girls except for Percival Perrinet Pierce.
What a name.
Yeah, it's a mouthful. It's a little Seussian.
We'll just call him Percy.
But what we find, especially at this stage in history, is that things begin to blur and get a little murky. So we know the big highlights of George Pierce's career, but for his personal motivations, other than the visionary approach to the car, those things may be lost to maybe family oral tradition or maybe diary entries or stuff, but things that are difficult to find. And it took us a while to verify that Percy was actually this guy's son.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah, it's crazy. And before we get any further, I want to point out that Hines and Munshauer are ghosts.
Yeah, it's difficult to find out anything about those guys. Now, I mean, Hines, you got to assume that that is the, you know, the condiment king Hines that we're talking about, you don't know that for sure. You know, there's more to this story than we're going to get to here, but I want to point out one place that people can go if they do want to dig into the background a little more.
Oh, yeah,
and if you bother to join the society, you might be able to dig up even more than we were on the sites that are available to the public. There's something called the Pierce Arrow Society, the PAS, and it's just piercearrow.org. And you can join there. You can sign up, you know, for a membership, and they've got like a quarterly newsletter, and there's a bunch of history and photographs and, you know, a lot of interesting links and, you know, lists of notable owners, which hopefully we'll get to today. And, this is where a lot of this history comes from. So they're a great source of information on some things, but other things I just couldn't find. And it must be buried in some of the member pages. But 1 year after that, or no, make that 2 years after that, after their very first, kind of foray into, you know, building this motorette vehicle, they built the first aero car, and it was a two-cylinder car that they built in 1903. And it wasn't called the Pierce Arrow, it was just called the aero car. And not long after that, again, a two-cylinder car, so it's probably really very simple in design and, and size and everything. In 1904, they came out with something called the Great Arrow, which is, of course, a greater version of what they had just created. And it's funny the way they named it, but this is where it kind of they step up their game a little bit, because the Great Arrow was a larger four-cylinder car, and it was more they described it as more luxurious and a lot more sturdy than the previous one, but it had cast aluminum body panels, which is interesting. They were using aluminum when everybody else is using steel at this point.
At that time, and it's also more expensive to fabricate.
Well, yeah, and did you see what the price of a Great Arrow was back in 1904?
I wanted to see if we could play the inflation game on this one.
Okay, I've got it.
All right.
All right, so the cost of a Great Arrow in 1904 was $4,000. Now, that was a huge sum of money. To give you an idea, and remember, this is only their second, well, I guess it'd be the third vehicle officially that they made. In 2016 dollars, that equates to $103,000.
Which the average person is not going to spring for.
$103,000 in 1904, the equivalent of it. So $4,000, that was a lot of money back then, but the prices only go up from there, because they're laying the groundwork for what becomes the basis of the whole company is that, and I'll say this probably a few times as we go through here, but they really focused on reliability, quality, craftsmanship, dependability, you know, just all the, just everything that you would want in a car, you would get in a Pierce. And it was, there were many measures in place to make sure that happened. I'll talk about some engine stuff
design.
Later. Some interesting things they did there for quality control, but they were already laying the groundwork for what would be one of the, if not the most reliable car on the road.
As you know, we're entering the Gilded Age, which is only a few years off from now. What they wanted to do was similar to what Rolls-Royce eventually became, like the car of kings, you know, the ultimate high-end thing that, yes, it's true that most people in the U.S. and abroad could never afford a vehicle of this level. But if they establish themselves as the most reliable manufacturers for those rarefied few who could afford a car like this, then their fortune was assured.
Yeah, so they're not talking to everybody else. They're talking to the ones that can afford the car and will pay for that extreme luxury, quality, dependability, etc. And you know, Ben, this is one thing that that's kind of really stuck out for me is that they called this in history, in U.S. history, I guess. The Pierce Arrow was one of what they called the fabled three P's of U.S. automotive royalty. This included, of course, Pierce Arrow, Peerless, and Packard. They were all known for superb craftsmanship, ultimate luxury. You know, they were the cars of presidents at one point, as we'll talk about. I mean, lots of presidents used these. It was actually official vehicles for a while.
Well, this an interesting thing there. We do have to establish that these were also in the public eye. While they weren't maybe directly advertising to the rank and file, people who were fans of racing would see the great arrow specifically, win endurance tests. Like in 1905, we talked about how Piercy would also race.
Yeah.
33 cars entered this, 1100 mile race from New York to New Hampshire. And the Great Arrow won. So it established it as the most reliable car.
These were the Glidden Tours, right?
Yes, yeah.
Okay,
yeah,
so the Glidden Tours were from 1905 to 1909.
Mm-hmm.
And like you said, they were kind of like an endurance race. They would last anywhere from 1,100 to, I think the longest one was around 2,600 miles. That one went from Detroit to Kansas. And I think, you know, in a circuitous route, of course. I mean, you know what roads were like at that time. Mm-hmm. There wasn't a direct route or anything.
There was no interstate.
Yeah, but what was deemed as the most roadworthy of the car was the one that was awarded the winner. And these cars, driven by Percy Pierce, would win every single year. And for four of those years, from 1906 to 1909, perfect scores. 1,000 out of 1,000 points were earned by him. And this is funny, Ben. One of the notes that said who accompanied him on these travels, at least in the first one in 1905, which, by the way, where he scored 996 out of 1,000. So he only missed 4 points over 5 years. That's pretty impressive. He was accompanied by his parents, his fiance, and a mechanic. So that's a car full of people traveling along with him in this in this endurance race. I just thought it was funny he brought his parents along with him, but it makes sense that his dad's there. He's the founder of the company.
Mm-hmm.
But bring his fiance. I guess the mechanic's essential. I don't know about bringing his mom, but you know, maybe that was all part of the deal. you can't do it unless I go with family vacation. I guess, you know, it's funny. Cars would have been so new at that point.
Oh, sure.
This would have been such a novelty to be able to go and see that much of the country.
This is still a world of horse-drawn carriages.
Yeah, I didn't even think about it that way. Is that, yeah, this is probably it comes up five more times, but, you know, a once-in-a-lifetime thing or a first-in-the-lifetime
opportunity. Oh, I imagine. So then it does make sense that the family would also want to travel.
Yeah.
When would that opportunity present itself again?
And they're doing so well selling this $4,000 the Great Arrow, that they were able to build a new factory. And what a factory did they, an amazing factory that they were able to
build.
Right,
right. By the famous architect Albert Kahn.
Mm-hmm.
This was at Elmwood Avenue, around 1906.
Yeah. Now remember, prior to this, they were in a 75,000 square foot facility, which is pretty big. That's big. And that was in Buffalo, New York also. So they remained in Buffalo the whole time. But, in 1906, they built this incredible new factory. Ben, how big was that factory?
Right. So just to establish context, first factory, 75,000 square feet. Huge, right? Huge.
Yeah.
This one is 1.5 million square feet.
Right. And this was like the best of the best, Ben. It was like the most modern manufacturing facility of its time. Mm. And you mentioned that it was built by or designed by Albert Kahn, who was an industrial architect. But it was located where the 1901 Pan American Exposition was held. And that was, of course, where – oh, there's so many sidebars here, Ben. That was the place where President McKinley was assassinated, the site anyways. But this new building was just incredible. It was like top of the line. It had a chemical laboratory. It had its own power plant. It had a laundry, two dining rooms, snack counters that served coffee, pie, and ice cream to employees. It was kind of like the modern Googleplex or whatever they call it.
Right.
It had everything. They wanted to make it a comfortable place for the employees. And contrast that with some of the old dark factories. You know, that didn't have much light and you know dirty and
noxious.
It was completely different. Now I don't know about the actual manufacturing floor of this place, but based on the quality and the type of vehicles that were coming out of there, I would assume that this was a different. Layout completely in that case. But it sounds like they were treating employees a little bit differently, too. I mean, that they were really, really, thoughtful about the way they did this.
And at the time, this might sound strange to some folks, the employee perks in the auto manufacturing industry were streets ahead of a lot of other manufacturing things. The idea, you'll hear sometimes when people talk about where the weekend came from, right? Countries around the world have a similar ratio of 5 days on, 2 days off, right? One of those days being a spiritual day of some sort, right? A Friday, a Saturday, a Sunday. The origin of the weekend in the United States comes from labor relations, right? And to, I know I'm sidebarring the sidebar. Mm-hmm. This is a little bit tangential, but it's so interesting. Henry Ford plays a role in the creation of the weekend. He doesn't necessarily lead the charge, but when he gave his employees 2 days off, instead of, you know, the typical maybe 1 day or day and a half or something, when he did that, that was this enormous manufacturing base sort of, I guess.
Shift?
Yeah, it was like a paradigm shift.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was legitimizing it in the eyes of other industry heads, in the eyes of the public and the government.
You know, I don't think that's something we covered when we talked about Ford a long, long time ago, or many times in the past. I don't think we've talked about how he was instrumental in the formation of what we consider the weekend.
Yeah, the original story of it comes from several mills in New England, and the employees, there was discord because some of the employees were Jewish, some of the employees were Christian. And so the Christians would not want to work on Sunday, which was their holy day. And the Jewish workers would not want to work on Saturday. So they would have these alternating things that were kind of messing up the workflow of the entire factory.
Sure. I can't get my job done because that guy's not here today, but tomorrow I'm going to be gone and then nothing's going to happen till Monday.
Et cetera. Yeah.
Okay.
And so they eventually had reached a compromise with the mill owners where they would just have both of those days. And there's earlier stuff with the weekend. You know, it does trace back to Europe, where people had the one holy day, but spent a lot of that time inside gambling dens and brothels and drinking. And so there was this huge epidemic of people just not going to work on Monday. And there was a interesting thing you can look up called Saint Monday. Anyway, we digress. I have a piece on the history of the weekend on our video show Brain Stuff, which is about everyday science. But Henry Ford wasn't completely altruistic when he led the charge for the weekend. Because he realized that if he had his employees working all the time and not having much time to go out and socialize, he was also keeping his best customers away from a dealership, away from an opportunity to buy a Model T or Model A. So by giving them those 2 days, what he also ended up doing was giving them a chance to, take – they're largely male, right? So to take the wife and kids out and say, oh, here are the cars that, you know, Papa makes, and then end up buying one.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It was a smart move.
Yeah.
It was really investing back into his company.
Yeah.
But these kind of innovations are tied hand in hand with early auto manufacturers because it was similar to, like you said, the Google strategy, which is make work a cool place, compensate the employees fairly, give them perks, give them an ice cream store, give them an extra day off, and see the results. And that's what we're seeing here. And this, man, this works. People are paying attention. As Scott said, presidents are paying attention. This factory speaks for itself. 1.5 million square feet. Pierce is going to get out of the game at this point. Just the same way that he got out of bicycles, he says, I'm going to sell the rights to this company.
Yeah, and actually, seeing what happens later on, I guess it was relatively decent timing for him to get out. In 1907, he sold all rights, you know, all name rights or whatever, to the company. And just 3 years later, the guy ended up dead.
Yeah, March 23rd, 1910.
So it's not a case where he worked right up until the day he died, but it's pretty darn close. And I guess when he got out was a good time because you know what happens with companies when the founder dies. You know, there's always some kind of
bloody fight for supremacy.
Yeah, that happens, and sometimes the company goes under, and you know, of course, his wishes aren't met. So you know, in this way, I guess he could probably be part of the deal and make sure that it was going into good hands, and you know, make sure that it was being handled the way he wanted to handle it.
Well, and also, you know, we have to consider what I call the Achilles heel of a company that's oriented around a personality. The most notable example in modern Western culture would be Apple, when Steve Jobs passed away, Apple got into some difficult times, and people weren't sure if the ship would right itself. It seems to be doing very well now.
Yeah, you lose kind of the front man of the operation, the one that, whose face you associate with that company or that product.
Right.
And that becomes difficult for some people. They don't know whether to hang with it or, you know, what the changes are going to bring. And I'm sure that was the case with this as well. But
would Tesla exist without Elon Musk if he passed away today?
Exactly. Yeah. So
I hope he doesn't. Please, Mr. Musk, hold on.
Yeah. Hang in there.
Get me to space.
But it all worked out well in this case. In 1908, they launched with a new name, you know, as we mentioned before. It was, just prior to this, it was called the Pierce Motor Company. And of course, now here's the dramatic change over to the Pierce Aero Motor Car Company.
Yes.
It's about the same.
Yeah, right. But check this out, you guys. We mentioned that notable people were paying attention to the innovative way this and other manufacturers were treating their employees, were popularizing their products via racing. In 1909, the president of the United States ordered two Pierce Aeros. He ordered four cars total, but two of them were Pierce Aeros to be used for state occasions. And this makes them the very first official cars of the White House.
Yeah, that's right. It's the very first time a U.S. president used automobiles for any kind of official occasion. And that was with Taft. And this is crazy. This kind of, I guess you call it tradition, I suppose, lasted with the Pierce Aeros until about 1935. And it ended during the FDR administration. And of course, that's because, well, you know, what happens with the company, not so much what happened, you know, they didn't want them anymore. But the cars were actually leased by the U.S. government, but the presidents would often buy those cars when they left the office. So these presidents would end up owning the vehicles as their own personal vehicles once they left the office.
Can't beat that advertisement.
Yeah, and you know what? I have to take another sidebar here.
Yeah.
And I don't have any notes in front of me, so this is just going from a story that I read yesterday. But maybe you can find this online if you dig around. The story behind Taft getting those two Pierce Aeros is pretty interesting. I think he wanted initially to get a Ford automobile, a couple of Fords.
Yeah.
And the reason was because, or no, maybe it wasn't him. He just needed cars. He needed two cars or four cars, as you said, or three or whatever the case may be. I read this, by the way, it was in a Ford forum. So, Ford, it was like an off topic thing. You know,
those other two cars were white Model M Tourers.
Of the white, you know what? I think one was a steam car as well. So Taft owned one white steam car made by the manufacturer White. But I think that what the story was that Taft had said, okay, we have $12,000 in the budget to buy these cars. We need to get three or four cars, as you said. And it's funny to think about that now, $12,000. But now the cars we just talked about, the Pierce Aeros that, of the time, they ended up buying a Brougham and a Landaulet, and they were right around $4,000 each, or maybe even $6,000 each. It was going to, you know, take the entire budget to buy them.
Mm-hmm.
His wife, or I'm sorry, the guy that was in charge of this, his name was like, I want to say he was a captain or a colonel or something. He was an advisor to Taft, and his last name was Butts. And it was, it's spelled the same way. It was spelled exactly like that, B-U-T-T. So he's in charge of it. He's got the budget, and it's like $12,000. He goes out and he finds, you know, the cars that fit the bill, you know, that he can get everything he needs, and it's these Ford cars. And Mrs. Taft, I don't remember her name, but she said, oh, no. The leader of the free world, you know, the head executive of the United States is not going to be seen in a car like that. He has to be in something prestigious, something with a name.
Yeah.
And she mentioned Pierce Aero as a possibility.
Mm-hmm.
So they looked into it and figured that they can get two of these, and I guess they extended the budget for the other two vehicles, the white steamer cars.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how he ended up with these Pierce Aeros, is because she didn't want him seen around town in something, and I'll say it, I mean, don't get angry at me, Ford guys, but as inferior as a Ford, when you could be seen as in something as superior as a Pierce Aero.
As common. I would say common versus elite.
Yeah, and see, this is before, like, Cadillac hadn't really found its groove yet.
Right.
And, of course, you know, we didn't see Lincolns in the White House really until the 1960s, I think. You know, the big Lincolns with the Kennedys. So, you know, Cadillac didn't really appear at the White House until the 1950s, I think.
Right.
But anyway, it's interesting that the Pierce Aeros were owned and sometimes, well, at least, and of course, sometimes owned by by presidents. And also, of course, this was Taft, Wilson, Harding, mm-hmm. Coolidge, Hoover, FDR. It's an impressive list, really.
Also, I would say it's a, I have opinions about the several of those presidents.
Well, but yeah, of course we have all of that.
But that's for a different kind of show, isn't it? I do want to point out though that
they have good taste in cars.
They have great taste in cars, and they had great help choosing those cars.
Sorry, Ben.
Yeah.
Oh, I have to get this in before I forget.
Yeah.
The guy that I mentioned before, Mr. Butts,
yeah,
or Colonel Butts, or whatever his name was,
yeah,
the poor guy, he died on the RMS Titanic on its maiden voyage.
Oh man!
So he selected these cars in 1909. 3 years later, he's on the Titanic in the on the fatal voyage.
You just never know.
I know. Okay. Well, sorry.
I had to ask, and this is pure speculation on my part, and listeners, please let me know what you think as well. So, in addition to his professional pros and cons, William Howard Taft holds the dubious honor of being by far the most overweight president, right?
Is he the one who got stuck in the bathtub?
The very same.
Oh, boy.
And yeah. So my question is, did the car's reliability have something to do with the decision as well? Because the other two P's were out there.
Yeah, possibly. Maybe that was it. Maybe it had significantly more room in the interior.
I'm wondering. Yeah, and this is not at all a crack on the guy.
Oh no.
Because I was spending some time in research thinking, how am I going to phrase this?
But you know what? Take a look at the cars of that era. You know, the 1909 era, and see what you find. But I think they were enormous. I think they were great, big, giant coaches. These are the kind of cars when you stand next to them, the hood is the same height as your shoulder. Mm-hmm. You know, they had those tall wheels with the wooden spokes and more like still like a carriage in some ways. Not exactly, but still a bit like that.
Mm-hmm.
So giant coachwork on them. I think maybe all cars had a lot of room. So I don't know if that was really a factor.
I'm just curious.
Because there was kind of that last minute switch, remember, too. If they wanted the Fords and then ended up with these Pierce Arrows. I don't know. I mean,
I feel like though, honestly, while I see what they're saying about being a state official, I feel like it might have been more popular with the public. You would have looked like more of a man of the people if you were in a Ford.
Well, probably, yeah.
Oh man, Scott, I just realized.
What's that?
It's happened again.
Oh, boy. We're running out of time, aren't we?
We're running out of time, my friends. We're deep in the story of the Pierce Arrow Motor Car Company, and ordinarily we would end an episode here, but I don't want to stop. The story's not over.
Oh, no. There's lots more to discuss here, so we're going to have to come back for a part two.
Yeah, let's do that. We're going to make the – you know what? By golly – by gum, we're going to make this – I looked up some archaic expressions of the time.
I like it.
By golly, by gum, we are going to make this a two-parter. We are going to be back next week with the second half of the story of the Pierce Arrow Motor Car Company. In the meantime, since we don't want to leave you on too much of a cliffhanger – if you would like to check out some of the origin stories of other car models and car manufacturers and just notable individuals in the history of automobiles, then you are in luck. You can visit carstuffshow.com to check out every other audio podcast we've ever done. Specifically recommend the Peugeot one. That would be a good one.
That's a good match for this one. Mm-hmm. Similar story, I think.
Yeah. And Steve, you have inspired us to make this a two-parter. Thank you so much for writing to us. If you would like to take a page from Steve's book and contact us with some information about your experience with the Pierce Arrow Motor Car Company, or if you would like to recommend a topic for us to cover in the future with the understanding that we might end up making it a series, then drop us a line. We're CarStuffHSW on Facebook and on Twitter. You can see a lot, especially on our Facebook, you can see a lot of the images that Scott and I are mentioning because we've got stuff popping up there every single day. And if you have something a little longer that you would like to say, or you know maybe a longer tale or anecdote about your experience with the Pierce Arrow, then we would love to hear it. You can email us directly. We are
carstuff@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@howstuffworks.com.